Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading The Atlantic magazine. Beginning today with an article from the May issue titled, Everything is Free and Nothing Matters. What I Saw at Jeff Bezos's Campfire Retreat by Noah Hawley. At the end of Paul Thomas Anderson's 2007 movie, There Will Be Blood, Daniel Day-Lewis's oil baron character, now old and richer than Croesus, beats Paul Dano's preacher to death with a bowling pin. Dano's Eli Sunday, a nemesis of Day-Lewis's Daniel Plainview during his seminal wealth-building years, has come to sell Plainview the oil-rich land that he once coveted. But Plainview doesn't need the land anymore because, as he explains in one of the most famous monologues in modern cinema, he has sucked out all the oil hidden beneath it from an adjoining property, like a milkshake. Desperate for money, Eli begs for a loan. Instead, Plainview chases him around a bowling alley and murders him with great enthusiasm. Once it's over, a butler comes to see what all the noise was about. "I'm finished," Plainview yells. No matter how many times I watch that movie, and I watch it a lot, I have never once taken those words to mean, "I'm done for. There will now be consequences for my actions." Quite the opposite. They mean that Plainview has completed his journey through the acquisition of wealth and power to a realm outside the moral universe. He's finished, in other words, pretending that the rules of human society apply to him. In 2018, I was a guest at Jeff Bezos's Campfire Retreat in Santa Barbara, California. It's an annual event in which the Amazon founder invites 80-plus guests, celebrities, artists, intellectuals, and anyone else he thinks is interesting, to spend 3 nights at a private resort. I had recently been approached by Amazon about moving my film and television business over from Disney, and although I had declined, or maybe because I had declined, Bezos's team invited me to Campfire, perhaps keen to impress me with the power of his reach. On a warm October Thursday, a fleet of private jets was dispatched to airports in Van Nuys and New York to shepherd guests to Santa Barbara in style. At that point, I had only a vague sense of who else was coming: famous people, rich people, influential people, and me. A guest list, I was told, would be given to us once we arrived. Families were invited. An on-site nanny would be provided for each child. So my wife and I got our 2 children from Austin to Los Angeles and took a 45-minute jet ride north with a television mogul and a comedian on board. Bezos had bought out the entire Biltmore Resort for the weekend, as well as the beach club across the street. He had brought in security from Las Vegas to ensure our safety and privacy. Even the weather felt expensive, and when we were shown to our rooms, the designer gift bags we found were filled with luxury goods. Each morning, we gathered in the lecture hall to hear presentations. If you've ever seen a TED Talk, you understand the format. The year I went, a sitting Supreme Court justice was interviewed, and a neurologist talked about technological advances in prosthetics. In the afternoons and evenings, we were encouraged to exchange ideas over drinks and 4-course meals with no set purpose, to network, in other words, with some of the most rarefied talent on earth. The most common question I heard was, "Why am I here?" "Why am I here?" asked the 1980s hair metal singer. "Why am I here?" asked the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, the famous anthropologist, the presidential historian. Only the movie stars and the billionaires didn't ask. They had done this kind of thing before. It turns out there is a circuit of idea festivals. Many tech billionaires host one, and if you find yourself on the right list, you can spend much of the year traveling the world, eating Wagyu, and discussing how to make the world a better place with the most famous talk show host in history. That's how the weekend started. Here's how it ended. My wife broke her wrist slipping on wet grass, and both children and I came down with hand, foot, and mouth disease. This is not a joke. One of us went home with her arm in a sling. The other three developed itchy, painful red blisters all over our faces and extremities. If you're looking for a sign from God as to whether hanging out with the richest man on earth is right for you, pay attention when he signs you not one plague, but two. Suffice it to say, we have never been back to Campfire, nor have we ever been invited. At drinks on the second night, the head of a major talent agency asked me what I thought of the weekend. I said, I've spent my whole career trying to figure out how the world works. I didn't realize I could just come here and ask the people who ran it. On some level, I was kidding. The lead singer of an alt-country band didn't run the world, nor did a noted author who would later be accused of impropriety. But finding myself at that resort by exclusive invitation, I now knew exactly what people meant when they talked about the elite. Sitting in the lecture hall, pencils out, listening to a famous chef explain his humanitarian work, it was easy to feel like the solution to the world's problems lay within our grasp. And yet, looking around at faces I had only ever seen in a magazine or on screen, I had an unsettling revelation. This is the hubris of accomplishment. To be declared a genius at one thing is to begin to believe you are a genius at everything. Here we were, 80 individuals with a combined net worth that was greater than a small city's, yet infinitesimal compared with the wealth and dominion of our host. How did he view this exercise? As a first step toward changing the world, or as a performative display of his reach and influence? Bezos was everywhere that weekend, in a tight T-shirt, laughing too loudly, arms thrown around his teenage sons. He had recently become the world's second centibillionaire, his net worth hovering somewhere around $112 billion, about half of what it is today. That number, previously unimaginable, had made him unique on a planet of 8 billion people, and you could feel it in the room. Even the richest and most famous among us were drawn to the energy of this impossible wealth. Though we didn't know it at the time, Bezos' first marriage would be over a few weeks later. My defining impression of his wife that weekend was sadness, even though Bezos made a big show of performing the role of family man. In hindsight, it is that performance that sticks with me. The Jeff Bezos of 2018 acted as if he still believed that people's impression of him mattered, that his financial and social value could be affected by negative publicity. He still believed that his actions had consequences. He had not yet freed himself, the way Daniel Plainview freed himself, from the rules of men. 8 years later, Bezos and two of the world's other richest men, Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, have clearly left the world of consequences behind. They float in a sensory deprivation tank the size of the planet, in which their actions are only ever judged by themselves. The closer I've gotten to the world of wealth, the more I understand that being truly rich doesn't mean amassing enough money to afford super yachts, private jets, or a million acres of land. It means that everything becomes effectively free. Any asset can be acquired, but nothing can ever be lost, because for soon-to-be trillionaires, no level of loss could significantly change their global standing or personal power. For them, the word failure has ceased to mean anything. This sense of invulnerability has deep psychological ramifications. If everything is free and nothing matters, then the world and other people exist only to be acted upon if they are acknowledged at all. This is different from classic narcissism, in which a grandiose but fragile self-image can mask deep insecurity. What I'm talking about is a self-definition in which the individual grows to the size of the universe and the universe vanishes. Asked recently if there is any check on his power, President Trump, himself a billionaire and by far the richest president in American history, said, "Yeah, there is one thing, my own mortality. my own mind. Excuse me. President Trump said, yeah, there is one thing, my own morality, my own mind. It's the only thing that can stop me. Not domestic or international law, not the will of the voters, not God or the centuries-old morality of civic and religious life. Decades of research in developmental psychology have shown that moral reasoning develops through consequences, not punishment necessarily, but experiencing the effects of your actions on others, receiving honest feedback, having to accommodate reality as it actually is, rather than as you wish it to be. It's not that the wealthy become evil. It's that their environment stops teaching them the things that non-wealthy people are forced to learn simply by living in a world that pushes back. When you can buy your way out of any mistake, when you can fire anyone who disagrees with you, when your social circle consists entirely of people who need something from you, the basic mechanism by which humans learn that other people are real goes dark. When Peter Thiel said, I no longer believe that freedom and democracy are compatible, he wasn't talking about your freedom. He was talking about his own. You don't exist. When Musk took a chainsaw to the federal government as part of the inside joke he called Doge, he did so with the air of a man who believed that nothing matters. Poverty, chaos, human suffering. He was having fun. It didn't even matter that the entire destructive exercise ultimately yielded no practical financial gains. For him, the outcome was a foregone conclusion. He could only win, because losing had lost its meaning. Since the 2024 election, there has been a philosophical shift on the right, and especially among tech billionaires, to vilify the idea of empathy. Musk has called empathy the fundamental weakness of Western civilization. He sees it as a weapon wielded by liberal society to bludgeon otherwise rational people into operating against their own interests. Empathy is something done to you by others, a vulnerability they exploit, a back door through which they gain access to your resources and will. This rejection of empathy as a human value gives cover to people who don't want to feel anything at all. If empathy is the problem, then lack of it isn't a deficiency, it's an advantage. I finally met Bezos on the last day of Campfire at lunch, after my wife had broken her wrist. I went over to thank him for having us, and he asked how our Campfire experience had been. I told him that it was great, but that unfortunately my wife had broken her wrist that morning when she slipped on the wet grass while kicking a ball with our 6-year-old son. The night before, we'd all stood by the pool at the beach club watching a cadre of synchronized swimmers execute a flawless water routine. I had spoken with a famous novelist who said, I just don't understand why I'm here. A famous rock star was about to start an acoustic set. The famous chef had made paella. Somewhere deep under my skin, a brutal pox was beginning to form. The next morning, my wife fell, and I found myself in a black SUV with a team of private security contractors who whisked us to the back entrance of a Santa Barbara emergency room where she was seen and treated right away. We made it back in time to watch the Supreme Court justice zoom in from Washington, D.C. How was your campfire? Bezos asked me an hour later. And because I am an honest person, and because I have been a host myself, I decided he would want to know that there had been a problem, but that his team had reacted quickly and been extremely helpful. To be clear, I was in no way blaming him, nor was I shaking down the richest man on earth. Instead, I was simply offering Bezos, also a husband and father, a brief human connection. But when I told him what had happened, Bezos looked horrified. He did not say, I'm so sorry. He did not say, do you need anything? Instead, he made a face, and in an instant, an aide came and whisked him away. When presented with the opportunity for empathy, even performative empathy, he chose escape. A few hours later, on the private plane home, a famous movie producer offered my wife a blanket. My children's faces were covered in spots. Under my fingernails, red welts were beginning to rise. The world has always been run by rich men. The robber barons of the Gilded Age were known for their ruthlessness in the accumulation of wealth, hiring Pinkertons to shoot striking unionists. But they directly engaged with the world around them, using their wealth and power to muscle it into its most profitable form. And though today's billionaires are clearly manipulating society to maximize their own profit, something else is also happening, a disassociation from the reality of cause and effect, from meaning and history. These men no longer feel the need to change the world in order to succeed, because their success is guaranteed, no matter what happens to the rest of us. "I'm finished," yells Daniel Plainview, perched happily on the polished floor of his own celestial kingdom. Though he has just committed a crime, he has never felt so free. Also from the May issue, the books column, Who is Black Comedy For? A new book is nostalgic for the 90s, but the era of crossover success was not necessarily the pinnacle of black comedic achievement. By K. Austin Collins. Early in his career, before he became a household name, Dave Chappelle attempted to get a series off the ground at Fox. It was 1998, and the network had already welcomed black comedies such as Living Single, Martin, and In Living Color, shows that implied a vested interest in black taste. Chappelle might have expected to find a receptive audience when he presented the pilot for Dave Chappelle, a sitcom based on his life as a young black comedian. What he reportedly got instead was a room full of white executives with a familiar set of complaints. There were not enough white people on his proposed show. It was not universal enough, meaning it was too black. Swap out the black female lead for a white one and add an additional white character, he was advised. All of this despite Fox being, as Chappelle put it at the time, a network that had built itself on black viewers. He refused to cooperate, remarking that the incident tells every black artist, no matter what you do, you need whites to succeed. Chappelle was caught up in a whirlwind of change in the TV landscape. The successes of black sitcoms in the 1980s and 90s had made new shows marketable for mainstream, read not just black, audiences, but that marketability had come with a catch. In the late 90s, there was a broader push for multiculturalism, which came to be defined, in a great many cases, as whiteness plus, white protagonists with their black, Asian, and Latino friends. Blackness not as a set of experiences in itself, but as proof positive of the white hero's ability to learn. Jokes that might offend or even just confuse white audiences became harder sells, and safe crossover appeal became the norm. A few years prior to Chappelle's pitch, Keenan Ivory Wayans, the creative force behind In Living Color, had left his show over issues that reportedly included censorship from Fox. Fast forward half a decade to the now famous story of Chappelle's show, the sketch series that began in 2003 on Comedy Central. We live in the comedy world that Chappelle conquered through the Miss Cleo parody, the racial draft, and I'm Rick James, bitch. He mastered a comic style that highlighted, He mastered a comic style that highlighted the absurdity of racism by taking it to its extremes, while also leaning on and exploring black in-jokes without translating them for white viewers. His bits became memes before most of us knew what a meme was, and, taking advantage of Comedy Central's comparatively lax rules, he insisted on using the N-word liberally. This Chappelle show was everything that the 1998 concept couldn't be. And ironically, though the show made no effort whatsoever to be universal, it nevertheless won a rabid and diverse audience. In 2005, Chappelle walked away from a reported $50 million contract he'd signed with Comedy Central the previous year. Most people were baffled by his decision, but in interviews, he explained that the fame and pressure had weighed on him and that the show's popularity, especially among people who were ostensibly the butt of the jokes, indicated that his work had not been received as he'd intended. In the end, Chappelle followed the logic he set for himself early on in his career. Mainstream approval was never more important than the integrity of the material or of its market. Chappelle's era of comedic dominance is the denouement of Black Out Loud, the revolutionary history of black comedy from vaudeville to 90s sitcoms, a new book by Jeff Bennett. A PBS NewsHour anchor, Bennett traces the trajectory of black comedy, beginning with the long backstory of its arrival in the network TV mainstream. The first of the book's two sections is a series of historical profiles of black comics, from the minstrel-era performer Billy Kersans through Eddie Murphy. Bennett then turns to several landmark black television shows of the 80s and 90s, series in which, as a youth, he could see blackness represented in a way that felt real and expansive. The book concludes with Chappelle's show. In Bennett's resolutely progressive view, the story of black comedy in America is of a steady march toward fearlessness. But Bennett measures progress mostly by the ability of black comedy to break barriers and achieve crossover appeal. The effect is to render black comedy that doesn't go mainstream, that remains just black, and thrives not in scripted shows on network television, but on tours and in comedy clubs, specials, films, TikToks, and Instagram reels, less relevant. This framing casts the grand lineage of black comedy as a vehicle for racial reconciliation. As Bennett tells it, the struggle that persists down the ancestral line of black comics is to courageously and cannily resist stereotypes, each generation less fettered than the one that came before us. Before it, I apologize. That process begins with blackface, mammies, and step and fetchets. Next come the winking subversions of those archetypes by the likes of Moms Mabley and Hattie McDaniel. They, in turn, lay the groundwork for the later, far more brash subversions of Red Fox, Dick Gregory, and in particular Richard Pryor, who perfected a singular brand of self-dissolving, linguistically nimble storytelling. Black Out Loud is an account of successive generations of black comics gradually persuading white audiences to see beyond caricature and accept black characters as people whose stories are worth paying attention to. In the 90s era of peak black sitcom, Bennett sees, on the one hand, reflection of America's begrudging acceptance of black culture, and on the other, the realization of black viewers' demand for sitcoms that offered authentic representation. Sitcoms made for black audiences prior to the 1990s were rarely under black creative control, and even 1970s-era classics such as Good Times and The Jeffersons offered up imperfect or stereotypical simulacra of black life. With more black creative input shaping successors, such as The Cosby Show, its spin-off A Different World, set at a historically black college, and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, however, the stories subtly poked at the rhythms that had been familiar to black TV. For example, when on The Fresh Prince, Will and Carlton are detained by racist cops while driving a Mercedes, the officer's presumption that the car must be stolen doubles as commentary on the show's popularity and on black upward mobility generally. We're not supposed to be here. It's a little strange, though, to lurch, as the book does, from the bawdy confrontations of Pryor, who tested his audience comfort with brash profanity and jokes about racial violence and graphic sex, including gay sex, to the wholesome fare of Family Matters, in which someone spray-painting the N-word on Laura Winslow's locker and telling her to go back to Africa was the subject of a very special episode. strange, that is, to fashion the era of Urkel as proof of a clear advancement from the era of Pryor. Progressive views of 20th century America are right in many ways to give us a sense of the cultural politics that were pushing the country forward, more rights, more opportunity, more representation. But the approach stumbles when it too eagerly smooths over the equally characteristic setbacks, divots, and reversals. Still, Bennett is compelling in his insistence that what unites the various threads of black comedic genius is an overarching trend toward black comics getting to be themselves. His reporting on Wayans' self-described dictatorship as In Living Color's creator, for example, highlights how, even at the risk of seeming irreverent or disrespectful, Wayans tried to fend off network meddling in achieving his singular vision. That doggedness helped chart a path for many of Bennett's subjects, including the rest of the Wayanses. This book is a genealogy, yes, but also a relay, stretching from performers hiding, literally, beneath layers of burnt cork, to, a century later, Chappelle donning a blonde wig and beige makeup to play a delectably too-white news anchor, who's even funnier for looking not quite right, or white. The satire cannot exist without the real. The history of blackface is what makes the cutting humor of Chappelle's whiteface possible. In that respect, Bennett's vision of black comedy's evolution as a steady march toward fearlessness makes undeniable sense. How did we get from Burt Williams and George Walker to extraordinary comic talents whose artistic legacy is complicated by their association with blackface, to black comedians being afforded the leverage to turn that shameful history into an epic in-joke? Part of the answer is the work of people like Hattie McDaniel, who is said to have quipped that she'd rather play a maid than be one. Bennett's effort to track this history incrementally through heroes whose symbolic cultural wins had measurable impact on what came after makes for a buoyant and agreeable book. Where he errs, however, is in holding up the era of crossover appeal as the apex of black comic achievement. To dwell on 90s network sitcoms, on black television playing on white networks in general, is to gauge the progress of black comedy in terms that are not always those of black comedians themselves. We can see the success of shows such as In Living Color and Family Matters as proof that the American experiment, with its promises of integration and acceptance, has finally worked. Or, we can acknowledge that the promise has always been contingent. You can tell jokes about race, but... Late in his life, the great Dick Gregory argued that black people should never turn to entertainment expecting liberation, and that white comedians were not burdened by these unrealistic hopes. Bob Hope ain't never changed nothing, he said. Fred Astaire ain't never fixed it so little children could eat. But as Black Out Loud makes clear, black popular entertainers are charged with needing to stand for something. Liberation, by way of representation, has long been a demand. Chappelle put it plainly, "White people, white artists are allowed to be individuals," he told Esquire in 2006, defending his choice to leave his show, "but we always have this greater struggle that we, at least, have to keep in mind somewhere." Of course, Chappelle did return after his hiatus, and the trajectory of his comeback is one of quite a few inconvenient truths that Bennett's book, interesting as it is, cannot account for. His relentlessly progressive arc struggles to explain the present, when Chappelle is controversial for jokes not about white people, but about trans people and Jews, when networks seem to have short leashes for the few black shows they do greenlight, when audiences are atomized and moving away from television altogether and toward comedians who make their bones on self-produced short-form videos, and when jokes about race land differently, given an openly white supremacist administration in the White House. Bennett scopes his inquiry to focus on the form that most interests him, and likely what makes for a manageable book, but the choice constrains his vision of fearlessness to one that mostly involved speaking to white audiences in a decade of multicultural awareness and through a network-dominated medium that would soon be on its way out. What if fearlessness, though, has nothing to do with white audiences or gatekeepers? If Chappelle himself represents the pinnacle of black comedic courage, then maybe his most important contributions to the canon isn't the Netflix specials or the Prince sketch, but the famous moment when he turned to a camera, and implicitly to black viewers, and cried, "This racism is killing me inside." Whether or not you subscribe to the idea that a black artist's job is to change the world, a history of that responsibility that sticks to the mainstream hardly paints a full picture. The real legacy of revolutionary black comedy might lead us not just to Family Matters and Chappelle's show, but also to the terrain claimed by black comedy that primarily serves black audiences, the way things were for the likes of Gregory and Flip Wilson, and for comedians such as the late Paul Mooney and Patrice O'Neill, and the still-kicking, still-hilarious Cat Williams. As much as I've missed Chappelle's show since it went kaput, I've missed shows such as Def Comedy Jam and BET's Comic View, the latter of which launched the careers of D.L. Hughley and Cedric the Entertainer, even more. These shows produced a generation of comics, actors, and presenters who are famous among black audiences but relatively unknown in white pop culture. Wary as I am of calling the often aggravating work of Tyler Perry revolutionary, the bulk of it, by and large, still appeals to black audiences, and only to black audiences. The longest-lived black sitcom, by episode count, is not The Jeffersons, The Cosby Show, or Family Matters, but Tyler Perry's House of Pain, which aired its 400th show this year. The aspirations of Pain and its ilk are not to cross over, nor to reify the values of the black middle class, but simply to be funny and black, all on their own terms. What's a revolutionary history without that? Next, also from the books section, the feeling of becoming less and less of a person. In Ben Lerner's new novel, Technology Divides Us Further from One Another and Ourselves, by Nicholas Dames. Let's hazard an assertion. On or about June 2007, human character changed. To be more exact, because the phrase human character now feels antique, we might say instead that the human sensorium changed. By this, we don't necessarily mean a sudden and definite alteration in how we perceive the world, in the forms, sources, and amount of information we absorb, and in how we conduct our relations with parents, children, spouses, partners, mentors, and friends. Excuse me. Yet, a transition was set in motion, differentiating life before the omnipresent smartphone and life after, and dating its onset to the birth of the iPhone seems apt. The above is a loose homage to words that Virginia Woolf wrote slightly more than a century ago about the collapse of Victorian gender and class norms, a shift that she placed more arbitrarily, with half-ironic playfulness, in December 1910. A decade and a half before her essay appeared. In both cases, the mutation seems at once massive and slippery, glaring and subtle. The effects are phenomena without edges, pervasive yet noticeable only when caught by middle-distance memory. Few things are as hard to discern as what was different about the recent past. Capturing changes like these calls less for history than for the oldest of forms, fable. Not far into Ben Lerner's transcription, you realize that a fable is, in fact, what you have entered. His new novel may be set roughly 2 years ago, and in a highly specific and contemporary milieu, but it is also about a man in the middle of his life, away from home, signposts vanished, and maps lost. Having slipped into a different world, he must now wonder where, if anywhere, he might feel at home. Only the reality-bending qualities of fable, perhaps, can evoke the threshold in human cognition that was crossed just a short while ago, and convey the mystery of how or if we have remained ourselves on the other side of that change. Transcription is the fourth novel by a writer who is not solely or even primarily a novelist. Lerner is also a poet and critic, and his novels are written as intermittent and experimental eruptions of engagement with some matter of urgent public concern. They fit within the quasi-biographical, reference-rich, largely plotless genre that the 2010s came to know as autofiction. Yet Lerner's version, which has the feel of theory in a different mode, has tilted slightly toward a much older tradition, the novel of ideas. Each successive novel has become less indirect about its subject. His debut, Leaving the Atocha Station, published in 2011, is a comic, cerebral coming-of-age novel about a young poet in the era of the War on Terror. Pressing issues claim the foreground more overtly 3 years later in 1004, in which Lerner evokes life in the shadow of climate change, and in The Topeka School, published in 2019. In that book, his characters confront the decline of American public speech, its degeneration into varieties of unreason, and the proto-fascist violence that follows. The novel's topicality is leavened by a critic's erudition and a poet's facility for turning abstractions into images. The protagonists of these books partially resemble Lerner himself, a male writer from Kansas, the product of an intellectual family and an elite education, eventually a resident of New York City. These figures seem to offer an internal portrait of the author as well. He's hyper-articulate and earnest, though prone to disconcerting fits of duplicity and rage. He's also almost paralyzingly aware of being the beneficiary of a wealthy nation's tangible and intangible resources, and aware that those resources aren't sufficient for a life lived well. Taken together, Lerner's first three novels have the contours of a trilogy, installments in a collective biography whose theme is the evolving disquiet, even anguish, of late imperial America. Transcription is and isn't like these predecessors. Lerner's alter ego has returned, unnamed here and now firmly middle-aged, and the terrain is still that of cosmopolitan, credentialed, coastal urban white America, steadily more embattled and self-doubting. But the book, divided into three encounters, conversations really, has an unusually stark quality that gives it the feel of a parable. The subject matter is also different. Lerner here turns to media theory, despite the risk that this might seem both in the clouds and mundane. He's training his attention on the phones in our pockets, on something very small and yet boundless in its effects. Here, Lerner's dual talents give him a unique purchase. The internet novel of recent years has tried very hard to sound just like the internet, to compete with, parody, or mimic the deadpan, knowing wit, and quick cuts of online discourse. Lerner's media theory is both more deliberately, novelistically banal, and more freely lyrical. Transcription is indeed about those phones and their most literal pedestrian appearances in our lives. At the same time, it is about how they have transformed the very guise of the world, which means that the novel is about change itself, about what living through epochal transition is like. Trying to explore this process is a project that lacks the dignity or sense of emergency associated with confronting climate disaster or authoritarianism. The experience is happening everywhere. It's the fish's theory of water. Helping us recognize the atmosphere we're immersed in has always been Lerner's talent. Transcription opens with its protagonist on a train to Providence, Rhode Island. He's en route to interview his former college mentor, Thomas, a renowned German media theorist and artist, for a magazine on the occasion of his 90th birthday. It is early 2024. Masking and rapid testing are still on his mind. While on the train, he texts his wife about their daughter's school anxiety, listens to a talk that his mentor gave half a century earlier, falls asleep and has a disturbing dream about trying to pick up his daughter at school and being turned away. Tugged at by both the young and the old, he starts to feel unmoored. At his hotel, preparing for the interview, he accidentally drops his phone, which he was counting on to record the interview, into a clogged sink. It goes black mirror. He has been sundered from the world, unable to locate an Apple store where he could replace the phone, unable to call his mentor to apologize in advance for being late, unable to make a promised FaceTime call to his daughter. He's as inaccessible as the dead. On his way to the interview, he experiences the shift as a transfiguring estrangement, a withdrawal indistinguishable from mild intoxication, the landscape made strange, the stones stonier. Unmediated by a screen, he is seized by an almost unbearably sharp feeling of presence, while he is also moving back into his own deviceless past, as if the providence of his youth has summoned itself from the underworld. We have entered the miraculous, uncannily familiar, possibly treacherous land of fable. Nothing captures the force of technology better than an enchantment that removes it, however temporarily. But the scene is also comically ordinary. He is just a man who cannot open his contacts. Defamiliarization, in transcription, always swerves back into the familiar, into realist farce. When he arrives at Thomas's house, an incoherent shame seizes him, and he cannot admit to his mentor that his phone is unusable. His frail interlocutor begins to speak, elegantly, passionately, about his own youth in Hitlerite Germany and the fascist radio speeches that form his earliest memories, but his words are not being captured. And as this unrecorded rhapsody progresses, dementia weaves its spell. Thomas begins to confuse his young mentee and interviewer with his own son, mixing fragments of family wounds and recriminations into his reverie, as if he's forgotten that he's being interviewed. Lerner's protagonist plays along politely, anxiously. What else can he do? The interview will have to begin again tomorrow with a new phone in any case. He fails to confess that nothing has been recorded. Thomas's sibylline, disorienting words slip into the void. We later learn, indirectly, that the promise tomorrow never comes, that Thomas's death has intervened and the recorded interview never occurs. The non-event is the void with which the novel's following two sections contend. The protagonist, we find out, has tried to fill it by publishing his conversation with Thomas as if it were a verbatim last interview, and the revelation of this imposture shocks not only Thomas's other acolytes, a deep fake, one calls it, made under false pretenses, but also Thomas's son Max, the protagonist's close friend from college. Their anger makes clear the scale of the protagonist's Oedipal betrayal. In the novel's final section, other cross-signals and cross-generational misperceptions emerge. Max now speaks, almost entirely uninterrupted, about his own failed communication with his father in recent years. He describes Thomas's near death from COVID in early 2020, during which a nurse held a smartphone to his ear so that Max could say a final goodbye of forgiveness and apology, a call that Thomas may or may not have heard. Max also recounts a later visit with his recovering father, in the course of which he surreptitiously recorded their conversation on a phone, another deception. All of this is framed by Max's narration of his young daughter's life-threatening eating disorder and the treatment that saved her. She was allowed to eat while glued to her iPad, watching the bizarre micro-genre of unboxing videos. Max relates all of this with a lucid matter-of-factness, because he is baffled by it. One might take transcription's final section as Max's absolution, tacit, maybe even a bit grudging, of his friend and his father's mentee for his transgression. Here the novel comes close to a kind of mythic resolution, one that lets us glimpse a deep, unappeasable desire to have the dead, or the dead's appointed representatives, forgive us, so that we may forgive them for having left us. Lerner, however, never lets us forget how entangled this need is with power cords and phones and screens, all the ganglia of modern networked life, and how these devices are both bridge and barrier between parents, children, and grandchildren. As Lerner's alter ego has aged through his four novels, he has acquired not just offspring, but a profound unease about the different world that the next generation already inhabits, one that the parent not only can't control, but can't even apprehend, as if the child's receptive organs are attuned to as yet unnamed hues and higher frequencies. Meanwhile, the world of aging parents threatens to vanish unrecorded. In the remembered/fabricated interview, Thomas provides a media metaphor for this, a split screen in which the young and old exist in parallel spaces. The question, Thomas adds, is how to depict the historical changes in atmosphere. Transcription is an attempt at an answer. Historical transitions have magically disorienting qualities. They are also a matter of prosaic, minute negotiations. Lerner's characters always have thickly rendered intellectual lives, but in transcription, their intellection is directed, more than ever before, toward what you might call getting used to it, finding ways to acclimatize to that new atmosphere. To the communication and storage devices in their pockets that, far more than any postmodern philosophy, have erased the feeling of embodied subjective presence in the world. To the anxiety disorders of their children, which have the portentous mystery of an oracle's riddle. To the garbling, which the novel relays in its opening section, of collective social historical memory. In this way, at least, transcription is traditional. When fiction contends with technological change, it often situates that change in the context of generational loss. Marcel Proust's reflection on the telephone, in the third volume of In Search of Lost Time, happens during a glitchy long-distance call with the narrator's grandmother, in which her disembodied voice, reduced by telephony to tympanic vibration, becomes a premonition of the grave. So too in Lerner. Parents and mentors die, traces of them captured or not, only in the fragile black box of the device. Children seem accessible only through it. The middle generation experience, the bidirectional mourning that comes of being split between the vanishing and the emergent, preoccupies transcription. If Lerner has an answer about how to acclimate, it's in transcription's turn away from the narration of consciousness, all of those second thoughts and dreamy associations that have until now been his fiction's primary mode. Its final section is only speech, simultaneously confessional, therapeutic, and testimonial, as if Lerner needed a form detached from the single mind. We are left just with voices, and those voices, in the novel's subtle and canny repetitions, begin to merge with one another, becoming polyphonic. Phrases and images from earlier in the novel return, echoed, no longer assignable to particular individuals. It's a way of capturing the tremendous de-selving of the networked world. In this novel, one generation will depart before needing to adjust to it. One generation will never have known anything else. And one generation might be able to record its happening to serve as the seismograph of a cognitive technological shift. This is what one recalls of transcription, not an action, not even really a scene, but a situation, the feeling of becoming less and less of a person. It's a hollow feeling, but strangely also a feeling of heightened sensitivity to almost everything, including your own disappearance. In all of the novel's layered voices, one can hear the trembling of elegy. Early in the book, Lerner's protagonist recalls a visit to the famous glass flowers in the Harvard Museum of Natural History. Small, painfully fragile artifacts, mimicking nature with hallucinatory detail, suspended carefully from wires. He notices, or imagines, it is impossible to tell, that they are vibrating imperceptibly. He thinks, the flowers were recording instruments of exquisite sensitivity. They are like seismographs, but also like phones, like data stored in the cloud, in the air. Air looms, Thomas jokingly puns at one point. The world, in transcription, is becoming air, the depersonalized, dematerialized, impalpable crossing of digital signals. The glass flowers, however, suggest that art can still respond to fluctuations in and of the air. Lerner's novel comes as close as we can yet imagine to honoring their delicate way of registering a change that is everywhere around us and that is making nonsense of the difference between inside us and outside us. Next, from the Atlantic Online, the biggest tell that something was written by AI. Look closely, and you'll see that every part of the text is not quite right. By Eve Fairbanks. A few weeks ago, where I live in Johannesburg, a man ran a stop sign and crashed into my Subaru. At the scene, he was frantic, unable to gather his thoughts. Half an hour later, I received a lengthy, perfectly grammatical text from him, elegantly explaining how he perceived the crash had happened. For a repair quote, I wrote to a mechanic I know, a man who used to text me in curt phrases riddled with shorthand. I got a response using just the same voice as the man who'd crashed into me, the distinctive voice of AI. In surveys, people consistently say they distrust AI-generated writing. But that hasn't stopped more and more of us from using it in everyday life to compose work emails and personal texts, to make shopping lists, even to write scripts for arguments with our spouses. I feel like I'm going nuts, the writer Jason Kobler complained in the tech outlet 404 Media under the cognitive load of trying to discern whether every piece of text he reads is real or fake. AI writing is also creeping into our most elite literary spaces, newspapers, opinion sections, books, literary magazines. I edit professionally, often working with authors renowned for their prose. Maybe 2 months ago, I began receiving a kind of submission I'd never gotten before, perfectly clean, without a stray comma, uniform in length, with evenly paced paragraphs, and a distinctive tone that was simultaneously breezy and grandiose. At first, I was surprised that people who prided themselves on their writing would turn to AI to write for them. Even 6 months ago, when I occasionally identified a paragraph in a writer's work that seemed AI-generated, they would apologize. Now some authors tell me they've embraced AI as a writing tool, no different from spell check or a laptop. The phrase is protean and euphemistic, covering everything from using ChatGPT to find a quote to having it compose a long essay based on a two-sentence prompt. The reason for the change is simple. Competition in journalism and academia and grant writing and even YouTube influencing is insanely fierce. The edge goes to those who can stand out in a deluge of content, which is achieved through cleanly packaged messaging and sheer volume. Even professional communicators who are confident in their writing and unsure that AI is a perfect replacement are under increasing pressure to use it, so long as they feel they're doing so within their profession's boundaries. The Atlantic, for the record, prohibits writers from using AI-generated text unless it's explicitly identified as such. People who aren't professional writers are making a similar calculation. AI program's efficiency in generating a smooth grammatical text is irresistible, whether you need a savvy sentence in a job application or a line of banter on a dating app. AI-generated writing can easily trick readers, especially if they're only skimming. Tutorials exist for how to strip the telltale signs of AI use from your writing, get rid of em dashes, colons, and of course, the now icky, it's not X, it's Y formulations. The problem is that the efficiency and frictionlessness that make AI appealing to writers are the same qualities that make it feel untrustworthy to readers. And readers are right not to trust it. No matter how much we may tell ourselves that AI is just a tool like spell check, it isn't. When we use AI to flesh out ideas, we lose the most important part of the writing process, thinking. AI is incapable of pausing to wonder whether it has chosen the wrong word. All of its sentences are grammatically perfect, but many of them also make no sense. And all substantially AI-generated writing is like this, under the hood. ChatGPT Pro agrees, though it has no idea why. Its perfect, often nonsensical sentences are the kind of communication we're becoming surrounded with. Its infiltration into every domain of our lives can't be stopped. Even people who don't use AI will begin sounding more like it. Maybe human writing will become like cloth-aged cheese or handloom rugs, an artisanal product created effortfully. Maybe we will come to treasure older writing, Herman Melville, George Orwell, Toni Morrison, all authenticated. Writing like this will be a fossil record for a kind of thought process we buried without realizing it. The other night, as I was drifting off to sleep, a 19th century poem popped into my head. Winkin', blinkin', and nod one night, sailed off in a wooden shoe, sailed on a river of crystal light into a sea of dew. A children's rhyme, but it had a new beauty. Or maybe smooth communiques that arrive on time and betray no confusion, doubt, or internal struggle, that polish up our images as affable, efficient, and universally, if superficially, wise, is what we want. But at least we should know what we're sacrificing. That concludes this week's reading from the Atlantic Magazine. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.